This is Audible.
Casino Royale by Ian Fleming. Read by Dan Stevens. Chapter 1. The Secret Agent. The scent and smoke and sweat of a casino are nauseating at 3 in the morning. Then the soul erosion produced by high gambling, a compost of greed and fear and nervous tension, becomes unbearable, and the senses awake and revolt from it. James Bond suddenly knew that he was tired. He always knew when his body or his mind had had enough, and he always acted on the knowledge. This helped him to avoid staleness and the sensual bluntness that breeds mistakes. He shifted himself unobtrusively away from the roulette he had been playing and went to stand for a moment at the brass rail which surrounded, breast high, the top table in the salle privée. Le Chiffre was still playing and still, apparently, winning. There was an untidy pile of flecked 100 mille plaque in front of him. In the shadow of his thick left arm there nestled a discreet stack of the big yellow ones, worth 500,000 francs each. Bond watched the curious, impressive profile for a time, and then he shrugged his shoulders to lighten his thoughts and moved away. The barrier surrounding the case comes as high as your chin, and the caissier, who is generally nothing more than a minor bank clerk, sits on a stool and dips into his piles of notes and pluck. These are ranged on shelves. They are on a level, behind the protecting barrier, with your groin. The caissier has a coche and a gun to protect him, and to heave over the barrier and steal some notes and then vault back and get out of the casino through the passages and doors would be impossible. And the caissier generally work in pairs. Bond reflected on the problem as he collected the sheaf of 100,000 and then the sheaves of 10,000 franc notes. With another part of his mind, he had a vision of tomorrow's regular morning meeting of the casino committee. Monsieur Le Chiffre made 2 million. He played his usual game. Miss Fairchild made 1 million in an hour and then left. She executed 3 banco of Monsieur Le Chiffre within an hour and then left. She played with coolness. Monsieur Le Vicomte de Villorin made 1,000,002 at roulette. He was playing the maximum on the first and last dozens. He was lucky. Then the Englishman, Mr. Bond, increased his winnings to exactly 3 million over the 2 days. He was playing a progressive system on red at table 5. Duclos, the chef de partie, has the details. It seems that he is persevering and plays in maximums. He has luck. His nerves seem good. On the soirée, the chemin de fer won X, the baccarat won Y, and the roulette won Z. The boule, which was again badly frequented, still makes its expenses.
Merci, Monsieur Javier.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Or something like that, thought Bond, as he pushed his way through the swing doors of the salle privée and nodded to the bored man in evening clothes, whose job it is to bar your entry and your exit with the electric foot switch which can lock the doors at any hint of trouble. And the casino committee would balance its books and break up to its homes or cafes for lunch. As for robbing the case, in which Bond himself was not personally concerned, but only interested, he reflected that it would take 10 good men, that they would certainly have to kill 1 or 2 employees, and that, anyway, you probably couldn't find 10 non-squeal killers in France, or in any other country, for the matter of that. As he gave 1,000 francs to the vestiaire and walked down the steps of the casino, Bond made up his mind that Le Chiffre would in no circumstances try to rob the case, and he put the contingency out of his mind. Instead, he explored his present physical sensations. He felt the dry, uncomfortable gravel under his evening shoes, the bad, harsh taste in his mouth and the slight sweat under his arms. He could feel his eyes filling their sockets. The front of his face, his nose and antrum were congested. He breathed the sweet night air deeply and focused his senses and his wits. He wanted to know if anyone had searched his room since he had left it before dinner. He walked across the broad boulevard and through the gardens to the Hotel Splendide. He smiled at the concierge who gave him his key, number 45 on the first floor, and took the cable. It was from Jamaica and read, Kingston, J.A. Bond Splendide, Royal Les Eaux, Seine Inférieure. Havana Cigar Production, All Cuban Factories, 1915, 10 million, repeat 10 million, stop. Hope this figure you require. Regards, De Silva. This meant that 10 million francs was on the way to him. It was the reply to a request Bond had sent that afternoon through Paris to his headquarters in London, asking for more funds. Paris had spoken to London, where Clements, the head of Bond's department, had spoken to M, who had smiled wryly and told the broker to fix it with the Treasury. Bond had once worked in Jamaica, and his cover on the Royale assignment was that of a very rich client of Messrs. Caffrey, the principal import and export firm of Jamaica. So he was being controlled through Jamaica, through a taciturn man who was head of the picture desk on the Daily Gleaner, the famous newspaper of the Caribbean. This man on the Gleaner, whose name was Fawcett, had been bookkeeper for one of the leading turtle fisheries on the Cayman Islands. One of the men from the Caymans who had volunteered on the outbreak of war, he had ended up as a paymaster's clerk in a small naval intelligence organization in Malta. At the end of the war, when, with a heavy heart, he was due to return to the Caymans, he was spotted by the section of the Secret Service concerned with the Caribbean. He was strenuously trained in photography and in some other arts, and, with the quiet connivance of an influential man in Jamaica, found his way to the picture desk of the Gleaner. In the intervals between sifting photographs submitted by the great agencies, Keystone, Wide World, Universal, INP and Reuter Photo, he would get peremptory instructions by telephone from a man he had never met to carry out certain simple operations requiring nothing but absolute discretion, speed and accuracy. For these occasional services, he received £20 a month, paid into his account with the Royal Bank of Canada by a fictitious relative in England. Fawcett's present assignment was to relay immediately to Bond, full rates, the text of messages which he received at home by telephone from his anonymous contact. He had been told by this contact that nothing he would be asked to send would arouse the suspicion of the Jamaican post office. So he was not surprised to find himself suddenly appointed string correspondent for the Maritime Press and Photo Agency, with press collect facilities to France and England, on a further monthly retainer of £10. He felt secure and encouraged, had visions of a BEM, and made the first payment on a Morris Minor. He also bought a green eyeshade, which he had long coveted, and which helped him to impose his personality on the picture desk. Some of this background to his cable passed through Bond's mind. He was used to oblique control and rather liked it. He felt it feather-bedded him a little, allowed him to give or take an hour or two in his communications with M. He knew that this was probably a fallacy, that probably there was another member of the service at Royal Les Eaux who was reporting independently, but it did give the illusion that he wasn't only 150 miles across the channel from that deadly office building near Regent's Park, being watched and judged by those few cold brains that made the whole show work. Just as Fawcett, the Cayman Islander in Kingston, knew that if he bought that Morris Minor outright, instead of signing the hire purchase agreement, someone in London would probably know, and want to know where the money had come from. Bond read the cable twice. He tore a telegram form off the pad on the desk, why give them carbon copies, and wrote his reply in capital letters. Thanks. Information should suffice. Bond. He handed this to the concierge and put the cable signed De Silva in his pocket. The employers, if any, of the concierge could bribe a copy out of the local post office, if the concierge hadn't already steamed the envelope open, or read the cable upside down in Bond's hand. He took his key and said good night and turned to the stairs, shaking his head at the liftman. Bond knew what an obliging danger signal a lift could be. He didn't expect anyone to be moving on the first floor, but he preferred to be prudent. Walking quietly up on the balls of his feet, he regretted the hubris of his reply to M via Jamaica. As a gambler, he knew it was a mistake to rely on too small a capital. Anyway, M probably wouldn't let him have any more. He shrugged his shoulders and turned off the stairs into the corridor and walked softly to the door of his room. Bond knew exactly where the switch was, and it was with one flow of motion that he stood on the threshold with the door full open, the light on, and a gun in his hand. The safe, empty room sneered at him. He ignored the half-open door of the bathroom, and, locking himself in, he turned up the bedlight and the mirror light and threw his gun on the settee beside the window. Then he bent down and inspected one of his own black hairs, which still lay undisturbed where he had left it before dinner, wedged into the drawer of the writing desk. Next, he examined a faint trace of talcum powder on the inner rim of the porcelain handle of the clothes cupboard. It appeared immaculate. He went into the bathroom, lifted the cover of the lavatory cistern, and verified the level of the water against a small scratch on the copper ballcock. Doing all this, inspecting these minute burglar alarms, did not make him feel foolish or self-conscious. He was a secret agent, and still alive thanks to his exact attention to the detail of his profession. Routine precautions were to him no more unreasonable than they would be to a deep-sea diver or a test pilot, or to any man earning danger money. Satisfied that his room had not been searched while he was at the casino, Bond undressed and took a cold shower. Then he lit his 70th cigarette of the day and sat down at the writing table with the thick wad of his stake money and winnings beside him, and entered some figures in a small notebook. Over the 2 days' play, he was up exactly 3 million francs. In London, he had been issued with 10 million, and he had asked London for a further 10. With this on its way to the local branch of Crédit Lyonnais, his working capital amounted to 23 million francs, or some £23,000. For a few moments, Bond sat motionless, gazing out of the window across the dark sea. Then he shoved the bundle of banknotes under the pillow of the ornate single bed, cleaned his teeth, turned out the lights, and climbed with relief between the harsh French sheets. For 10 minutes he lay on his left side, reflecting on the events of the day. Then he turned over and focused his mind towards the tunnel of sleep. His last action was to slip his right hand under the pillow until it rested under the butt of the .38 Colt Police Positive with the sawn barrel. Then he slept, and with the warmth and humour of his eyes extinguished, his features relapsed into a taciturn mask, ironical, brutal, and cold. Chapter 2. Dossier for M. 2 weeks before, this memorandum had gone from Station S of the Secret Service to M, who was then, and is today, head of this adjunct to the British Defence Ministries. To M, from Head of S. Subject: a project for the destruction of Monsieur Le Chiffre, alias The Number, Herr Nummer, Herr Ziffer, etc. One of the opposition's chief agents in France, and undercover paymaster of the Syndicat des Ouvriers d'Alsace, the communist-controlled trade union in the heavy and transport industries of Alsace, and, as we know, an important fifth column in the event of war with Redland. Documentation, Head of Archives biography of Le Chiffre, is attached at Appendix A, also Appendix B, a note on SMERSH. We have been feeling for some time that Le Chiffre is getting into deep water. In nearly all respects, he is an admirable agent of the USSR, but his gross physical habits and predilections are an Achilles heel, of which we have been able to take advantage from time to time, and one of his mistresses is a Eurasian, number 1860, controlled by Station F, who has recently been able to obtain insight into his private affairs. Briefly, it seems that Le Chiffre is on the brink of a financial crisis. Certain straws in the wind were noticed by 1860, some discreet sales of jewellery, the disposal of a villa at Antibes, and a general tendency to check the loose spending which has always been a feature of his way of life. Further inquiries were made with the help of our friends of the Deuxième Bureau, with whom we have been working jointly on this case, and a curious story has come to light. In January 1946, Le Chiffre bought control of a chain of brothels known as the Cordon Jaune, operating in Normandy and Brittany. He was foolish enough to employ for this purpose some 50 million francs of the monies entrusted to him by Leningrad Section 3 for the financing of SODA, the trade union mentioned above. Normally, the cordon jaune would have proved a most excellent investment, and it is possible that Le Chiffre was motivated more by a desire to increase his union funds than by the hope of lining his own pocket by speculating with his employer's money. However that may be, it is clear that he could have found many investments more savoury than prostitution if he had not been tempted by the by-product of unlimited women for his personal use. Fate rebuked him with terrifying swiftness. Barely 3 months later, on the 13th of April, there was passed in France law number 46685, entitled Loi tendant à la fermeture des maisons de tolérance et au renforcement de la lutte contre le proxénétisme. When M came to this sentence, he grunted and pressed a switch on the intercom.
Head of S.
Sir?
What the hell does this word mean? He spelt it out.
Pimping, sir.
This is not the Berlitz School of Languages, Head of S. If you want to show off your knowledge of foreign jawbreakers, be good enough to provide a crib. Better still, write in English.
Sorry, sir.
M released the switch and turned back to the memorandum. This law, he read, known popularly as La Loi Marthe Richard, closing all houses of ill fame and forbidding the sale of pornographic books and films, knocked the bottom out of his investment almost overnight, and suddenly Le Chiffre was faced with a serious deficit in his union funds. In desperation, he turned his open houses into maisons de passe, where clandestine rendezvous could be arranged on the borderline of the law, and he continued to operate one or two cinéma bleu underground. But these shifts in no way served to cover his overheads, and all attempts to sell his investment, even at a heavy loss, failed dismally. Meanwhile, the police des mœurs were on his trail, and in a short while, 20 or more of his establishments were closed down. The police were, of course, only interested in this man as a big-time brothel keeper, and it was not until we expressed an interest in his finances that the Deuxième Bureau unearthed the parallel dossier which was running with their colleagues of the police department. The significance of the situation became apparent to us and to our French friends, and, in the past few months, a veritable rat hunt has been operated by the police after the establishments of the Cordon Jaune, with the result that today nothing remains of Le Chiffre's original investment, and any routine inquiry would reveal a deficit of around 50 million francs in the trade union funds, of which he is the treasurer and paymaster. It does not seem that the suspicions of Leningrad have been aroused yet, but, unfortunately for Le Chiffre, it is possible that at any rate SMERSH is on the scent. Last week, a high-grade source of Station P reported that a senior official of this efficient organ of Soviet vengeance had left Warsaw for Strasbourg via the eastern sector of Berlin. There is no confirmation of this report from the Deuxième Bureau, nor from the authorities in Strasbourg, who are reliable and thorough, and there is also no news from Le Chiffre's headquarters there, which we have well covered by a double agent, in addition to 1860. If Le Chiffre knew that SMERSH was on his tail, or that they had the smallest suspicion of him, he would have no alternative but to commit suicide or attempt to escape. But his present plan suggests that while he is certainly desperate, he does not yet realise that his life may be at stake. It is these rather spectacular plans of his that have suggested to us a counter-operation, which, though risky and unconventional, we submit at the end of this memorandum with confidence. In brief, Le Chiffre plans, we believe, to follow the example of most other desperate till robbers and make good the deficit in his accounts by gambling. The bourse is too slow. So are the various illicit traffics in drugs or rare medicines, such as aureo and streptomycin and cortisone. No racetracks could carry the sort of stakes he will have to play, and, if he won, he would more likely be killed than paid off. In any case, we know that he has withdrawn the final 25 million francs from the treasury of his union, and that he has taken a small villa in the neighbourhood of Royal-les-Eaux, just north of Dieppe, for a week, from a fortnight tomorrow. Now it is expected that the casino at Royal will see the highest gambling in Europe this summer. In an effort to wrest the big money from Deauville and Le Touquet, the Société des Bains de Mer de Royal have leased the Baccarat and the two top Chemin de Fer tables to the Mahomet Ali Syndicate, a group of émigré Egyptian bankers and businessmen with, it is said, a call on certain royal funds, who have for years been trying to cut in on the profits of Zografos and his Greek associates, resulting from their monopoly of the highest French baccarat banks. With the help of discreet publicity, a considerable number of the biggest operators in America and Europe have been encouraged to book at Royal this summer, and it seems possible that this old-fashioned watering place will regain some of its Victorian renown. Be that as it may, it is here that Le Chiffre will, we are confident, endeavour on or after the 15th of June to make a profit at baccarat of 50 million francs on a working capital of 25 million, and, incidentally, save his life. Proposed counter-operation. It would be greatly in the interests of this country and of the other nations of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that this powerful Soviet agent should be ridiculed and destroyed, that his communist trade union should be bankrupted and brought into disrepute, and that this potential fifth column, with a strength of 50,000, capable in time of war of controlling a wide sector of France's northern frontier, should lose faith and cohesion. All this would result if Le Chiffre could be defeated at the tables. Nota bene, assassination is pointless. Leningrad would quickly cover up his defalcations and make him into a martyr. We therefore recommend that the finest gambler available to the service should be given the necessary funds and endeavour to out-gamble this man. The risks are obvious, and the possible loss to the secret funds is high, but other operations on which large sums have been hazarded have had fewer chances of success, often for a smaller objective. If the decision is unfavourable, the only alternative would be to place our information and our recommendations in the hands of the Deuxième Bureau, or of our American colleagues at the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington. Both of these organisations would doubtless be delighted to take over the scheme. Signed, S. Appendix A. Name, Le Chiffre. Aliases, variations on the word cipher or number in different languages, e.g. Herr Ziffer. Origin, unknown. First encountered as a displaced person, inmate of Dachau DP camp in the US zone of Germany, June 1945. Apparently suffering from amnesia and paralysis of vocal cords. Query. Both feigned? Dumbness succumbed to therapy, but subject continued to claim total loss of memory, except associations with Alsace-Lorraine and Strasbourg, whither he was transferred in September 1945, on stateless passport number 304596. Adopted the name Le Chiffre, since I am only a number on a passport. No Christian names. Age, about 45. Description, height 5'8", weight 18 stone, complexion very pale, clean-shaven, hair red-brown, en brosse, eyes very dark brown with white showing all-round iris, small, rather feminine mouth. False teeth of expensive quality. Ears small, with large lobes indicating some Jewish blood. Hands small, well-tended, hirsute. Feet small. Racially, subject is probably a mixture of Mediterranean with Prussian or Polish strains. Dresses well and meticulously, generally in dark double-breasted suits. Smokes incessantly, caporal, using a denicotizing holder. At frequent intervals inhales from benzedrine inhaler. Voice soft and even. Bilingual in French and English. Good German. Traces of Marseillais accent. Smiles infrequently. Does not laugh. Habits. Mostly expensive but discreet. Large sexual appetites. Flatulent. Expert driver of fast cars. Adept with small arms and other forms of personal combat, including knives. Carries 3 ever-sharp razor blades in hat band, heel of left shoe, and cigarette case. Knowledge of accountancy and mathematics. Fine gambler. Always accompanied by 2 armed guards, well-dressed, 1 French, 1 German. Details available. Comment. A formidable and dangerous agent of the USSR, controlled by Leningrad Section 3 through Paris. Signed, Archivist. Appendix B. Subject, SMERSH. Sources, own archives and scanty material made available by Deuxième Bureau and CIA Washington. SMERSH is a conjunction of 2 Russian words, smert shpionem, meaning roughly, death to spies. ranks above MWD, formerly NKVD, and is believed to come under the personal direction of Beria. Headquarters, Leningrad, substation at Moscow. Its task is the elimination of all forms of treachery and backsliding within the various branches of the Soviet Secret Service and Secret Police, at home and abroad. It is the most powerful and feared organization in the USSR, and is popularly believed never to have failed in a mission of vengeance. It is thought that SMERSH was responsible for the assassination of Trotsky in Mexico, 22nd of August 1940, and may indeed have made its name with this successful murder after attempts by other Russian individuals and organizations had failed. SMERSH was next heard of when Hitler attacked Russia. It was then rapidly expanded to cope with treachery and double agents during the retreat of the Soviet forces in 1941. At that time it worked as an execution squad for the NKVD, and its present selective mission was not so clearly defined. The organization itself was thoroughly purged after the war, and is now believed to consist of only a few hundred operatives of very high quality divided into five sections. Department 1, in charge of counterintelligence among Soviet organizations at home and abroad. Department 2, operations including executions. Department 3, administration and finance. Department 4, investigations and legal work, personnel. Department 5, prosecutions, the section which passes final judgment on all victims. Only one SMERSH operative has come into our hands since the war, Goichev, alias Garrod Jones. He shot Pechora, medical officer at the Yugoslav embassy in Hyde Park, 7th of August 1948. During interrogation, he committed suicide by swallowing a coat button of compressed potassium cyanide. He revealed nothing beyond his membership of SMERSH, of which he was arrogantly boastful. We believe that the following British double agents were victims of SMERSH: Donovan, Harthrop Vane, Elizabeth Dumont, Ventnor, Mace, Savarin. For details, see Morgue, Section Q. Conclusion. Every effort should be made to improve our knowledge of this very powerful organization and destroy its operatives. Chapter 3, Number 007. Head of S, the section of the Secret Service concerned with the Soviet Union, was so keen on his plan for the destruction of Le Chiffre, and it was basically his own plan, that he took the memorandum himself and went up to the top floor of the gloomy building overlooking Regent's Park and through the green baize door and along the corridor to the end room. He walked belligerently up to M's chief of staff, a young sapper who had earned his spurs as one of the secretariat to the Chiefs of Staff Committee after having been wounded during a sabotage operation in 1944, and had kept his sense of humour in spite of both experiences. "Now, look here, Bill. I want to sell something to the Chief. Is this a good moment?" "What do you think, Penny?" The Chief of Staff turned to M's private secretary, who shared the room with him. Miss Moneypenny would have been desirable but for her eyes, which were cool and direct and quizzical. "Should be all right. He won a bit of a victory at the FO this morning, and he's not got anyone for the next half an hour." She smiled encouragingly at Head of S, whom she liked for himself and for the importance of his section. "Well, here's the dope, Bill." He handed over the black folder with the red star, which stood for Top Secret. "And for God's sake look enthusiastic when you give it him. And tell him I'll wait here and read a good code book while he's considering it. He may want some more details, and anyway, I want to see you two don't pester him with anything else until he's finished." "All right, sir." The Chief of Staff pressed a switch and leant towards the intercom on his desk.
"Yes?"
asked a quiet, flat voice.
"Head of S has an urgent docket for you, sir."
There was a pause.
"Bring it in," said the voice.
The Chief of Staff released the switch and stood up.
"Thanks, Bill. I'll be next door," said Head of S.
The Chief of Staff crossed his office and went through the double doors leading into M's room. In a moment he came out, and over the entrance a small blue light burned the warning that M was not to be disturbed. Later, a triumphant Head of S said to his number two, "We nearly cooked ourselves with that last paragraph. He said it was subversion and blackmail. He got pretty sharp about it. Anyway, he approves. Says the idea is crazy, but worth trying if the Treasury will play, and he thinks they will.
He's going to tell them it's a better gamble than the money we're putting into deserting Russian colonels who turn double after a few months' asylum here. And he's longing to get at Le Chiffre. And anyway, he's got the right man and wants to try him out on the job.
Who is it?
Asked number two.
One of the 00s. I guess 007.
He's tough, and M thinks there may be trouble with those gunmen of Le Chiffre's. He must be pretty good with the cards, or he wouldn't have sat in the casino in Monte Carlo for 2 months before the war, watching the Romanian team work their stuff with the invisible ink and the dark glasses. He and the deuxième bowled them out in the end, and 007 turned in 1,000,000 francs he had won at Chenny. Good money in those days.
James Bond's interview with M had been short.
"What about it, Bond?"
asked M when Bond came back into his room after reading Head of S's memorandum and after gazing for 10 minutes out of the waiting room window at the distant trees in the park. Bond looked across the desk into the shrewd, clear eyes.
"It's very kind of you, sir. I'd like to do it. But I can't promise to win. The odds at Baccarat are the best after Trente et Quarante, evens except for the tiny Cagnotte. But I might get a bad run against me and get cleaned out. Play's going to be pretty high. Opening will go up to 500,000, I should think."
Bond was stopped by the cold eyes. M knew all this already, knew the odds at Baccarat as well as Bond. That was his job, knowing the odds at everything, and knowing men, his own and the opposition's. Bond wished he had kept quiet about his misgivings.
"He can have a bad run too," said M. "You'll have plenty of capital. Up to 25,000,000, the same as him. We'll start you on 10 and send you another 10 when you've had a look round. You can make the extra 5 yourself."
He smiled. "Go over a few days before the big game starts and get your hand in. Have a talk to Q about rooms and trains and any equipment you want. The paymaster will fix the funds. I'm going to ask the deuxième to stand by. It's their territory, and as it is, we shall be lucky if they don't kick up rough. I'll try and persuade them to send Matisse. You seem to get on well with him in Monte Carlo on that other casino job. And I'm going to tell Washington because of the NATO angle. CIA have got one or two good men at Fontainebleau with the joint intelligence chaps there. Anything else?"
Bond shook his head.
"I'd certainly like to have Matisse, sir."
"Well, we'll see. Try and bring it off. We're going to look pretty foolish if you don't. And watch out. This sounds an amusing job, but I don't think it's going to be. Le Chiffre is a good man. Well, best of luck."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Bond, and went to the door.
"Just a minute."
Bond turned.
"I think I'll keep you covered, Bond. Two heads are better than one, and you'll need someone to run your communications. I'll think it over. They'll get in touch with you at Royal. You needn't worry. It'll be someone good."
Bond would have preferred to work alone, but one didn't argue with M. He left the room hoping that the man they sent would be loyal to him, and neither stupid nor, worse still, ambitious.
Chapter 4 L'ennemi écoute.
As 2 weeks later James Bond awoke in his room at the Hotel Splendide, some of this history passed through his mind. He had arrived at Royal Les Eaux in time for luncheon 2 days before. There had been no attempt to contact him, and there had been no flicker of curiosity when he had signed the register, James Bond, Port Maria, Jamaica. M had expressed no interest in his cover.
"Once you start to make a set at Le Chiffre at the tables, you'll have had it," he said. "But wear a cover that will stick with the general public."
Bond knew Jamaica well, so he asked to be controlled from there, and to pass as a Jamaican plantocrat whose father had made his pile in tobacco and sugar, and whose son chose to play it away on the stock markets and in casinos. If inquiries were made, he would quote Charles de Silva of Caffrey's, Kingston, as his attorney. Charles would make the story stick. Bond had spent the last 2 afternoons and most of the nights at the casino playing complicated progression systems on the even chances at roulette. He made a high banco at Chemin de Fer whenever he heard one offered. If he lost, he would suivi once and not chase it further if he lost the second time. In this way, he had made some 3,000,000 francs and had given his nerves and card sense a thorough workout. He had got the geography of the casino clear in his mind, Above all, he had been able to observe Le Chiffre at the tables, and to note ruefully that he was a faultless and lucky gambler. Bond liked to make a good breakfast. After a cold shower, he sat at the writing table in front of the window. He looked out at the beautiful day and consumed half a pint of iced orange juice, 3 scrambled eggs and bacon, and a double portion of coffee without sugar. He lit his first cigarette, a Balkan and Turkish mixture made for him by Morlands of Grosvenor Street, and watched the small waves lick the long seashore and the fishing fleet from Dieppe string out towards the June heat haze, followed by a paper chase of herring gulls. He was lost in his thoughts when the telephone rang. It was the concierge announcing that a director of Radio Stentor was waiting below with the wireless set he had ordered from Paris. "Of course," said Bond. "Send him up." This was the cover fixed by the Deuxième Bureau for their liaison man with Bond. Bond watched the door, hoping that it would be Matisse. When Matisse came in, a respectable businessman carrying a large square parcel by its leather handle, Bond smiled broadly and would have greeted him with warmth if Matisse had not frowned and held up his free hand after carefully closing the door.
"I have just arrived from Paris, monsieur, and here is the set you asked to have on approval. 5 valves, superette, I think you call it in England, and you should be able to get most of the capitals of Europe from Royal. There are no mountains for 40 miles in any direction."
"It sounds all right," said Bond, lifting his eyebrows at this mystery-making. Matisse paid no attention. He placed the set, which he had unwrapped, on the floor beside the unlit panel electric fire below the mantelpiece.
"It is just past 11," he said, "and I see that the Compagnon de la Chanson should now be on the medium wave from Rome. They are touring Europe. Let us see what the reception is like. It should be a fair test."
He winked. Bond noticed that he had turned the volume on to full, and that the red light indicating the long wave band was illuminated, though the set was still silent. Matisse fiddled at the back of the set. Suddenly an appalling roar of static filled the small room. Matisse gazed at the set for a few seconds with benevolence, and then turned it off, and his voice was full of dismay.
"My dear monsieur, forgive me, please, badly tuned."
And he again bent to the dials. After a few adjustments, the close harmony of the French came over the air, and Matisse walked up and clapped Bond very hard on the back and wrung his hand until Bond's fingers ached. Bond smiled back at him. "Now, what the hell?" he asked.
"My dear friend," Matisse was delighted, "you are blown, blown, blown up there." He pointed at the ceiling. "At this moment, either Monsieur Muntz or his alleged wife, allegedly bedridden with a grip, is deafened, absolutely deafened, and I hope in agony."
He grinned with pleasure at Bond's frown of disbelief. Matisse sat down on the bed and ripped open a packet of Caporal with his thumbnail. Bond waited. Matisse was satisfied with the sensation his words had caused. He became serious.
"How it has happened, I don't know. They must have been on to you for several days before you arrived. The opposition is here in real strength. Above you is the Muntz family. He is German. She is from somewhere in Central Europe, perhaps a Czech. This is an old-fashioned hotel. There are disused chimneys behind these electric fires. Just here," he pointed a few inches above the panel fire, "is suspended a very powerful radio pickup. The wires run up the chimney to behind the Muntz's electric fire, where there is an amplifier. In their room is a wire recorder and a pair of earphones on which the Muntz's listen in turn. That is why Madame Muntz has the grip and takes all her meals in bed, and why Monsieur Muntz has to be constantly at her side instead of enjoying the sunshine and the gambling of this delightful resort. Some of this we knew because in France we are very clever. The rest we confirmed by unscrewing your electric fire a few hours before you got here."
Suspiciously, Bond walked over and examined the screws which secured the panel to the wall. Their grooves showed minute scratches.
"Now it is time for a little more play-acting," said Matisse.
He walked over to the radio, which was still transmitting close harmony to its audience of 3, and switched it off.
"Are you satisfied, monsieur?"
he asked.
"You notice how clearly they come over. Are they not a wonderful team?"
He made a winding motion with his right hand and raised his eyebrows. "They are so good," said Bond, "that I would like to hear the rest of the programme." He grinned at the thought of the angry glances which the Munzes must be exchanging overhead. "The machine itself seems splendid. Just what I was looking for to take back to Jamaica." Matisse made a sarcastic grimace and switched back to the Rome programme.
"You and your Jamaica,"
he said, and sat down again on the bed. Bond frowned at him. "Well, it's no good crying over spilt milk," he said. "We didn't expect the cover to stick for long, but it's worrying that they bowled it out so soon." He searched his mind in vain for a clue. Could the Russians have broken one of our ciphers? If so, he might just as well pack up and go home. He and his job would have been stripped naked. Matisse seemed to read his mind.
"It can't have been a cipher," he said. "Anyway, we told London at once, and they will have changed them.
A pretty flap we caused, I can tell you." He smiled with the satisfaction of a friendly rival.
"And now to business, before our good compagnon run out of breath. First of all,"
and he inhaled a thick lungful of Caporal,
"you will be pleased with your number two. She is very beautiful."
Bond frowned.
"Very beautiful indeed."
Satisfied with Bond's reaction, Matisse continued.
"She has black hair, blue eyes, and splendid protuberances.
Back and front," he added.
"And she is a wireless expert, which, though sexually less interesting, makes her a perfect employee of Radio Stentor and assistant to myself in my capacity as wireless salesman for this rich summer season down here."
He grinned.
"We are both staying in the hotel, and my assistant will thus be on hand in case your new radio breaks down. All new machines, even French ones, are apt to have teething troubles in the first day or two, and occasionally at night," he added with an exaggerated wink.
Bond was not amused. "What the hell do they want to send me a woman for?" he said bitterly. "Do they think this is a bloody picnic?"
Matisse interrupted. "Calm yourself, my dear James. She is as serious as you could wish, and as cold as an icicle. She speaks French like a native and knows her job backwards. Her cover is perfect, and I have arranged for her to team up with you quite smoothly. What is more natural than that you should pick up a pretty girl here? As a Jamaican millionaire," he coughed respectfully, "what with your hot blood and all, you would look naked without one."
Bond grunted dubiously. "Any other surprises?" he asked suspiciously.
"Nothing very much," answered Matisse. "Le chief is installed in his villa. It's about 10 miles down the coast road. He has his two guards with him. They look pretty capable fellows. One of them has been seen visiting a little pension in the town where three mysterious and rather subhuman characters checked in 2 days ago. They may be part of the team. Their papers are in order, stateless checks apparently. But one of our men says the language they talk in the room is Bulgarian. We don't see many of those around. They are mostly used against the Turks and the Yugoslavs. They are stupid but obedient. The Russians use them for simple killings, or as fall guys for the more complicated ones."
"Thanks very much. Which is mine to be?" asked Bond. "Anything else?"
"No. Come to the bar of the Hermitage before lunch. I'll fix the introduction. Ask her to dinner this evening. Then it will be natural for her to come into the casino with you. I'll be there too, but in the background. I've got one or two good chaps, and we'll keep an eye on you. Oh, and there's an American called Leiter here, staying in the hotel. Felix Leiter. He's the CIA chap from Fontainebleau. London told me to tell you. He looks okay. May come in useful."
A torrent of Italian burst from the wireless set on the floor. Matisse switched it off, and they exchanged some phrases about the set and about how Bond should pay for it. Then, with effusive farewells and a final wink, Matisse bowed himself out. Bond sat at the window and gathered his thoughts. Nothing that Matisse had told him was reassuring. He was completely blown and under really professional surveillance. An attempt might be made to put him away even before he had had a chance to pit himself against Le Chiffre at the tables. The Russians had no stupid prejudices about murder. And then there was this pest of a girl. He sighed. Women were for recreation. On a job, they got in the way and fogged things up with sex and hurt feelings and all the emotional baggage they carried around. One had to look out for them and take care of them. Bitch, said Bond. And then, remembering the Muntzes, he said, bitch, again more loudly, and walked out of the room. Chapter 5 The Girl from Headquarters. It was 12 o'clock when Bond left the Splendide, and the clock on the Mairie was stumbling through its midday carillon. There was a strong scent of pine and mimosa in the air, and the freshly watered gardens of the casino opposite, interspersed with neatly gravelled parterre and paths, lent the scene a pretty formalism, more appropriate to ballet than to melodrama. The sun shone, and there was a gaiety and sparkle in the air, which seemed to promise well for the new era of fashion and prosperity for which the little seaside town, after many vicissitudes, was making its gallant bid. Royal-les-Eaux, which lies near the mouth of the Somme before the flat coastline soars up from the beaches of southern Picardy to the Brittany cliffs which run on to Le Havre, had experienced much the same fortunes as Trouville. Royal, without the O, also started as a small fishing village, and its rise to fame as a fashionable watering place during the Second Empire was as meteoric as that of Trouville. But as Deauville killed Trouville, so, after a long period of decline, did Le Touquet kill Royal. At the turn of the century, when things were going badly for the little seaside town, and when the fashion was to combine pleasure with a cure, a natural spring in the hills behind Royal was discovered to contain enough diluted sulphur to have a beneficent effect on the liver. Since all French people suffer from liver complaints, Royal quickly became Royal-les-Eaux, and Eau Royale, in a torpedo-shaped bottle, grafted itself demurely onto the tail of the mineral water lists in hotels and restaurant cars. It did not long withstand the powerful combines of Vichy and Perrier and Vittel. There came a series of lawsuits. A number of people lost a lot of money, and very soon its sale was again entirely local. Royal fell back on the takings from French and English families during the summer, on its fishing fleet in winter, and on the crumbs which fell to its elegantly dilapidated casino from the tables at Le Touquet. But there was something splendid about the Negresco Baroque of the Casino Royal, a strong whiff of Victorian elegance and luxury, and in 1950 Royal caught the fancy of a syndicate in Paris which disposed of large funds belonging to a group of expatriate Vichyites. Brighton had been revived since the war, and Nice. Nostalgia for more spacious, golden times might be a source of revenue. The casino was repainted in its original white and gilt, and the rooms decorated in the palest grey with wine-red carpets and curtains. Vast chandeliers were suspended from the ceilings. The gardens were spruced, and the fountains played again, and the two main hotels, the Splendide and the Hermitage, were prinked and furbished and restaffed. Even the small town and the Vieux-Port managed to fix welcoming smiles across their ravaged faces, and the main street became gay with the vitrines of great Paris jewellers and couturiers, tempted down for a butterfly season by rent-free sights and lavish promises. Then the Mahomet Ali syndicate was cajoled into starting a high game in the casino, and the Société des Bains de Mer de Royal felt that now, at last, Le Touquet would have to yield up some of the treasure stolen over the years from its parent plage. Against the background of this luminous and sparkling stage, Bond stood in the sunshine and felt his mission to be incongruous and remote, and his dark profession an affront to his fellow actors. He shrugged away the momentary feeling of unease, and walked round the back of his hotel and down the ramp to the garage. Before his rendezvous at the Hermitage, he decided to take his car down the coast road and have a quick look at Le Chief's villa, and then drive back by the inland road until it crossed the Route Nationale to Paris. Bond's car was his only personal hobby. One of the last of the 4.5-litre Bentleys with the supercharger by Amherst Villas, he had bought it almost new in 1933, and had kept it in careful storage through the war. It was still serviced every year, and in London a former Bentley mechanic, who worked in a garage near Bond's Chelsea flat, tended it with jealous care. Bond drove it hard and well, and with an almost sensual pleasure. It was a battleship grey convertible coupe, which really did convert, and it was capable of touring at 90 with 30 miles an hour in reserve. Bond eased the car out of the garage and up the ramp, and soon the loitering drumbeat of the 2-inch exhaust was echoing down the tree-lined boulevard, through the crowded main street of the little town, and off through the sand dunes to the south. An hour later, Bond walked into the Hermitage bar and chose a table near one of the broad windows. The room was sumptuous with those over-masculine trappings which, together with briar pipes and wire-haired terriers, spell luxury in France. Everything was brass-studded leather and polished mahogany,